I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. The United States has been through an epoch of incarceration. 40 years of the war on drugs and the imprisonment of hundreds of thousands of men and women. At the start of 2014, the U.S. prison population was 1.57 million, according to the Justice Department. We represent 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the world's incarcerated. One of every 9 prisoners is serving a life sentence, many without the chance for parole. Today, a conversation with Robert Ferguson, a scholar of law and literature, on the American brand of punishment. Why we send so many of our citizens to prison and for so long. Does this level of punishment achieve what we think it does? First, the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. Good afternoon. Dan Rodericks here, thanking you again for joining us on Midday. American taxpayers spend about $80 billion a year to maintain our prisons, and that does not include the costs of law enforcement, the courts, and all the consequences that so much incarceration has on families and communities. We have been through an epoch of incarceration, 40-plus years of the war on drugs, mass arrests, and the imprisonment of hundreds of thousands of men and women. At the start of 2014, the U.S. prison population was 1.57 million. That's according to the Justice Department. For those who thought they heard that the American prisoner population had dropped, you did hear that correctly. But that number I cited, 1,574,700 state and federal inmates, as of December 31st, 2013, represents an increase of 4,300 prisoners over the previous year, and the first increase in the state prison population reported since 2009. So after a few years of decline, the prison populations grew again. Maryland's prisons reached their capacity of 24,000 inmates back in 2002, while the 2013 population of prisoners in Maryland was down to 21,500, that's still nearly 10,000 more inmates than Maryland incarcerated in the 1980s. The state spends about $37,000 per inmate per year now. According to the Justice Policy Institute, which tracks Maryland prison policy, 30% of people in our prisons had a drug offense as their most serious offense. The U.S. represents 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the world's incarcerated. One of every 9 prisoners is serving a life sentence, many without the chance for parole. Is this what we want? Is this something you even think about? Does it bother you? Today, a conversation with Robert Ferguson, a scholar of law and literature at Columbia University Law School, on the American brand of punishment, why we send so many of our citizens to prison and for so long. Does this level of punishment achieve what we think it does? What is the purpose of all this incarceration? Is it a reflection of the level of criminality in society or a reflection of our impulse to punish and punish severely? Robert Ferguson believes we have a drive to punish, that American culture and tradition support what he calls a logic of severity that we'll discuss in this hour of the show. Robert Ferguson is the George Edward Woodberry Professor in Law, Literature, and Criticism at Columbia University. He has thought long and hard on the question of punishment in the age of mass incarceration. He's written a book about it. It's called Inferno, An Anatomy of American Punishment, published by Harvard University Press earlier this year. Robert Ferguson, welcome to Midday. It's great to get to speak with you.
Welcome, Dan. I'm glad to be on the show.
You know, some people might have just listened now to the facts, that litany of facts that I recited, culled from several sources about the number of people in prison today and over the last 40 years or so, and they might have said, good, society is safer, American society is safer because we incarcerate so many people. What do you say when you hear that?
Well, I have several responses. One response is the figures you cited does not include the number of people in jails, which brings that number well above 1.5 million
people. That's right, local detention centers and jails, right.
Local detention centers. The other answer I would have to people would be the recidivism rate in prisons is very, very high. 67% who are in prison who are released within 3 years will be back in prison. So the system isn't working. One prisoner has written to me that if you want to teach people how to be criminals, send them to prison. Our prisons aren't really helping people. They're just holding them. The phrase for this is warehousing. We need to do a better job of helping people readjust to reenter regular social life. But beyond that, we're just throwing away so many lives that should bother people.
Is this something inherent in our culture? Because it wasn't always thus. The last 40 years with the war on drugs has seen increased incarceration. It wasn't always this way.
Some of it happened with the upsweep in crime in the late 80s and early 90s. In fact, crime has decreased, but we are nonetheless continuing to put more people in prison than we used to. Some of this is momentum. Some of it is over-criminalization, where we have three or four different kinds of ways of punishing a person for the same offense. Some of it, though, is, I think, the way we think. One of the things I argue in my book is that the positive things about our culture often inflect negatively when we think about punishment. And I can go through some of those if you would like.
I would like that.
Well, the first is we believe in proportionality in punishment. That is, you only punish to a certain extent. But if you start punishment at a high level, let's say 4 years for simple assault, by the time you get to manslaughter, the number of years that people are going to serve is going to be quite high. Moreover, if punishment is not working, if there is a high recidivism rate, our inclination is to increase it. I think this is a natural psychological reaction that reaches well beyond America. The idea that if it isn't working, you increase it leads to greater severity. We believe in judicial independence, but this is also a way of people thinking that judges might be lenient on sentencing, so we have mandatory sentencing to prevent that. We believe in mercy as a people. We believe in second chances, but we believe also that criminals will take advantage of it. We believe in crime prevention, but we think committed criminals won't be reached by that. This culture has a huge distrust of governmental authority, and so we believe that government is not really handling the problem as well as it should. It's a country that likes to think it's exceptional, and it is exceptional in many ways. Look how many people want to come here. On the other hand, that means that we are reluctant to learn anything from other cultures, and there are other cultures that handle imprisonment in better ways.
Go right ahead, please.
We believe in national security. It's a big problem for us. But that also allows us to think that there are enemies everywhere. So we're sort of ready to see more criminals than I think are out there. We believe in military prowess. It's the part of our government that is most respected. But that means we also think that force is often the answer to a problem. We believe in bearing arms. That's in our Constitution. But we also believe they can be used when we feel threatened. And the question is, well, how great is the threat before you use your weapon? We believe in forgiveness, but in religious terms, we don't believe in forgiveness until sin is paid for. This is a religious nation that inflects both ways, both in terms of thoughts of mercy, but also, I think, in terms of punishment. We believe in toleration, but we also connect it with freedom. And once your freedom is taken away from you, we care about you a lot less. So all of these factors, I think, are important in why a country that actually has very good virtues might lead itself to punish more heavily than is probably a good idea.
I've been pondering punishment since reading your book. You say again and again that we don't know what punishment means. This comes up frequently in your writings. Most people would say, well, I know what punishment means. I understand. Right. I just understand the criminal justice system. It would be nice if we had corrections and corrections, but really the first instinct is to punish someone for committing a crime, for harming others, for stealing property. I understand what punishment is. What do you mean that we don't?
Two things. The first thing philosophically that I argue is that punishment is a pleasure. If you don't like that word, use the word satisfaction. When a parent punishes a child and says, this hurts me more than it hurts you, that parent is lying. In fact, punishment is a satisfaction. The second element, and you need to recognize that as a factor in why people are willing to be severe at times, particularly if the first punishment is not working. But the second factor, I got into this because from my teaching, I discovered that I could give a class of 70 law students in prosecutorial discretion, I could give them a problem where they had to recommend a sentence to a judge for somebody they were trying to convict. And I could get those 70 people to argue over the proper thing to recommend to a judge and argue angrily all the way from 6 months of house arrest to 20 years in prison on the same facts. So this led me to believe that people don't quite understand what punishment is. Here's one way of thinking about it. This comes from a judge who's a friend of mine and actually a colleague. If you say 72 months in prison, that doesn't sound like a huge amount of time. But if instead you say you go into jail when your daughter is 12 and come out when she's 18, then that is a lot of time, and it has totally disrupted everything that might happen in that child's life as well as the person going to prison. Now, you're right. There are some people who belong in prison. There are predators in our midst, and our culture throws them up with too much frequency. But most people don't need to be in prison for more than a couple of years in order to for that prison experience to do any good for them. So we punish so much more heavily for some of the crimes that that we have on the books. Hmm.
There are a couple of cases that I wanted to discuss with you today that are based here in Maryland that gave me pause when I read in my own newspaper, the Baltimore Sun, the resolution of these cases, the sentences handed out. I had to stop for a minute and think, does this seem just to me? Is that word justice or just will come into this? So I thought, Professor Ferguson, I'd throw these out here to our audience and let folks ponder this a little bit and talk to us, talk to me and you during this hour of the show about these cases.
That'd be great.
So let me.
I always have something to learn on this subject. Well, I don't think there are any experts on punishment.
Right. Well, here's one that gave me pause. This is the most recent one. This is just from last week or the week before. A 51-year-old woman in Baltimore, a grandmother, sentenced to 40 years in prison in the death of a 1-year-old grandson and the abuse of a granddaughter after a judge said she rubbed methadone onto the children's gums before she put them to bed and headed off to a party. This is a woman I wrote about actually in my column, Tawanda Reeves, 51 years old. I had interviewed her some years ago, it turns out, by coincidence. Anyway, she ended up in Baltimore criminal court facing these charges. There was a trial. A jury found her guilty. She received 30 years for second-degree murder of the one child. Both these children were under 2 years old. And 30 years for child abuse resulting in death to be served concurrently. She received 10 years for child abuse in the case of the little girl. So there I thought for a moment, well, it's a very terrible, tragic situation. A 51-year-old woman who's herself had issues with drug abuse for a long time in Baltimore City, using methadone to, I guess she thought, to put the children to sleep or something, and then one of them dies. So 40 years in prison at the age of 51 years old for her. What do you think of that? I'll ask my audience, what do you think of that sentence in that case? What is the point? Is it punishment? Is it to send a message to the greater society? That's one case that I'll cite. The other one is a 15-year-old boy, Perry Hall High School, 2012, the first day of school. Remember the shooting that occurred in Perry Hall High School in the cafeteria? The boy in that case who shot the gun and wounded one of his classmates in the cafeteria was 15 years old, sentenced to 35 years in prison. The judge in that case went beyond state sentencing guidelines to put that young man away until he is at least 50 years old. And the judge cited continuing fear in Perry Hall, along with a concern for school safety that had grown out of the, of course, the massacre up in Connecticut. So those are the two cases I thought, well, what's going on here? What is justice served? Is it punishment? Do we mean to correct? Do we mean to send a message with these sentences? What are we getting out of it? So let me take a break here, Professor Ferguson. I'll let you think about those two cases and then get your comments on them when we get back.
Great. Thank you.
Robert Ferguson joining us, distinguished law professor at Columbia University. His book is Inferno. We'll tell you about that title during this hour of the show. Inferno, An Anatomy of American Punishment. You can share your thoughts with me and Professor Ferguson this hour, 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. The Midday email address, midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to the Midday Show. Dan Roderick's here. Our guest this hour, joining us from Columbia University Law School, Robert Ferguson, his book, Inferno, An Anatomy of American Punishment. It sounds like you teach a great class there. This is interdisciplinary law, literature, and criticism at Columbia University. So I'd like to come up and monitor it, Professor Ferguson. It sounds really interesting. So let me go back to our cases. Those two cases that I cited, and get your reflections on them, and then we'll hear from some of our listeners.
Well, let me start first with the first case of the 40-year-old woman.
51-year-old woman.
51-year-old woman.
Sentenced to 40 years, yes.
Sentenced to 40 years. Infanticide is a really terrible crime, but I'd want to know if that was the case here. What was her intent in putting methadone on the lips of the child? Methadone can be seen as a substitute for heroin. Did she have any reason to feel that the children had been born with an addiction in such a way as, in other words, I would very much want to know what she thought she was doing. We punish by intent in crime. Second, you have to wonder whether she has a previous record, because if that's the case, then it's quite possible that this snowballs on her in terms of what she faces here. Either way, I think 41 years in prison is probably not a good idea in almost any case. That's a life sentence. Most cultures do not believe in life sentences, and this one would be without parole. Now, we have some 60,000 people in that situation and 159,000 people in life sentences. That's a unique level of punishment in our culture.
I think she would be eligible for parole after, I don't know how long, maybe a third of the sentence. Let me fill in here a little bit. She did say in court before sentencing, "I'm not very good at speaking, but the kids know that I never meant to hurt the children," referring to her family. The judge in that case, Judge Timothy Dory of the Circuit Court of Baltimore, said, "This is not the intentional killing of her grandson, but those who think this was some form of tragic accident misunderstand the case and misunderstand the jury's analysis of it. This is murder." So she was found guilty of second-degree murder. She was going out to a party, and I guess she thought this was a way of putting the children to sleep while she went out.
Well, the Greeks used to put opium on their children's pacifiers. I'm not suggesting it was a good idea in this case at all, and probably the fact that she was going to a party probably had some effect here. The judge has more information than we do, mm-hmm. but I still think the law says for certain forms of ignorance, you are responsible. And given that she had been a drug addict, but is not, I think, one at the time of this
It's not clear.
She must have known what methadone would do. She probably had no idea, though, of what it would do to a small baby. So there's clear negligence here. I don't see criminal intent in the same way. It is a level of negligence that you might think of as involuntary manslaughter. As early as Aristotle, people talk about what's your level of responsibility for an accident where you do something where you're not sure what is going to happen and can't predict it, for doing something where you know there could be harm, in which case there's negligence and you can be punished, or if there is intent to harm, in which case that is a criminal event. The judge, in saying this was murder, decided there was intent.
Since you're asking us to question almost everything about the criminal justice system and our high rate of incarceration, and this question, the word punishment, to ponder it, then I wonder what's achieved by this, sending a message to others, put methadone on the lips of children. What's the point of the punishment here? It removes a woman from society who killed a child?
That must be behind it. There's a certain notion. Retribution is one of our strongest reasons for punishing people. The reason why we believe in retribution is that it's a balancing act. All crime is about there's a normal situation, a transgression happens in which someone is hurt, and the job of the law is to bring people back to some form of equilibrium and safety in their society. I don't think this punishment really gives us that equilibrium, but I don't know all of the facts.
Okay.
I don't know what her lawyer was. I'll bet she didn't have the best counsel, probably a very poor woman. Where was the baby's mother? This is the grandmother. Has she been left taking care of yet another generation? Is she resentful of that? All of these factors, I hope, came up at trial. But either way, the people who should be in jail for 40 years or even until they're 60, and let's remember that most people don't commit crimes after they're 35 in terms of violence in any case.
You have to think that
the people you put away for a long time have to be predators, and that's not the case in this woman.
Right. Thank you, Professor. Let's go to the other case briefly then. Your thoughts about a 15-year-old boy sentenced to 35 years in prison for a shooting in a school cafeteria that wounded one and certainly frightened many other people.
We've learned that juvenile minds are not as fully developed as adult ones. They're dealing with lots of pressures that they don't understand. Their bodies and their minds haven't come together in quite the same way. To punish this person as an adult seems to me to be harsh, given the amount of sentence that he was given. I know from things that you've written about it, the fact that the boy showed no repentance after the event probably figured prominently in his punishment. Even so, we can expect people to change when they're young. The great thing about teaching the young, I have to say, is they improve, they change, they grow up, they mature. Putting this person in prison until he's 50, you're taking away any chance he has to a reasonable life when he comes out. What is he going to do at 50 years old? Who's going to take care of him then? Who's going to give him a job? So I'm not sure it serves the best interest. And you mentioned earlier about the expense. What is this, $37,000
a year
for this person?
Yes, $37,000 a year in Maryland. Yeah.
Put that in terms of 30 years, and you have a lot of money that the state of Maryland or wherever this person was is costing the state.
Professor Ferguson, I'd like to bring our listeners into this conversation, get their thoughts about this, too, and to ask Robert Ferguson any questions that they may have. Inferno is the name of his book, Anatomy of American Punishment. Let's get some comments from our listeners here. Tony in Baltimore, we'll go to you first. Thank you for calling.
Right. How you doing, Dan?
Okay. What do you think about these two cases?
Yeah, well, I think both of the cases are off the mark, but I'll speak about the one about the young man and professor. He made my point exactly, which is that, you know, the development of the young mind in men, I'm not sure about women, I know that they say in men, really doesn't have a full cognizant ability to all the consequences of their actions until their early 20s or even mid-20s. And so to give a young man that, you know, all teenagers make mistakes and their ability to figure out all the consequences of mistakes just aren't there. To give this type of person a lifetime sentence, I think, is just it's missing the mark.
Yeah, and it's not clear from the testimony that the young man in this case understood the consequences of his actions when he was doing it, according to the psychiatric testimony.
Right, and that's my point. Even if he did, and I know this is treading on some slippery slopes here, but even if he did, at 15, you've got to be able to say to any 15-year-old, you know, at some point, we are going to let you develop and become a part of our society again without spending 30 years in jail, you know.
Right.
I might add to what
Tony. Yeah.
I might add to what Tony has said that I think this probably happened because we've had a whole series of shootings in schools of late, and the judge was probably thinking about deterrence. But again, that doesn't justify for me what this sentence is.
410-662-8780 is our phone number for midday as we continue our conversation with Professor Ferguson. I'll take another call here. This is Maggie in Baltimore. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. Peace and blessings to both of you.
Thank you.
I'm enjoying the professor because I think not many of those who are on that professional level is asking the humane question about our government and how it's operating. And I also want to include my question about whether jurors really understand what punishment is, and do jurors understand cruel and unusual punishment? And also, are jurors actually forced to be, by lack of knowledge, a part of cruel and unusual punishment?
Professor, I'll go to you. Speaking of cruel and unusual, I just want to add before we go on, a lot of people associate that with the death penalty. It can also be associated with solitary confinement. And the numbers of people in the United States in long-term solitary confinement is very disturbing to me. It's something like 50,000 currently or within the last year or so.
We don't know, at least that many.
Yeah.
Because when the maximum security prisons, we don't have the information we need on that.
What about the juror's role in this? Yeah.
Right. In response to the question, I think correction officers, no one grows up wanting to be a correction officer, just as no one grows up wanting to go to prison. I think they have a hard job. They're injured more frequently than others. They retire as soon as they can. They have a higher suicide rate. It's a little like NFL players. But I'd have to say that they're not educated in the way they need to be to deal with the populations and the clientele that they're dealing with. They think of it as a war with the people they're taking care of, and so do the prisoners. All of them talk about battle and using military imagery of that kind. The problem we have is treating punishment strictly as deprivation. Instead of thinking about the capabilities of the person who's in prison and what we can do to really turn them around. And prison guards are not trained to really help in any way. In many cases, they hurt. There are many cases of abuse by prison guards. There are many cases of prison guards encouraging prisoners to abuse other prisoners. It's a hidden scandal that is coming out. There are a number of instances of this. In New York, we have the scandal over Rikers. You had a scandal in Baltimore last year about gangs taking over prison management with the cooperation of prison guards.
At the Baltimore City Detention Center, yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we need to change that. We need to...
Professor, I want to go back to the question the caller asked, Maggie, about jurors.
Yeah.
People who sit on juries and find someone guilty because they've, you know, deliberated, considered the facts, may not understand.
I misunderstood. I thought she was saying jailers.
She was wondering about jurors.
Okay.
Yeah.
In that case,
that's fine.
I think what I would say is most jurors want to do the right thing. But what they decide is whether someone is guilty or not. The sentence is the business of the judge. And the judge is often held in place by mandatory sentencing. I don't think jurors are particularly malicious. I think, as I said, they try to do the best job they can. Something depends on that person's background. Something depends on the nature of the crime. We try to pick jurors who are neutral on the event that's coming before them. Does that always happen? It does not. Jurors make mistakes, but it should interest Maggie that the facts show that jurors do not punish any more heavily than do judges when they have the option of making that decision or encouraging that decision or agreeing with the decision. Often a judge, after the event, will ask a jury about that.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, the sentencing takes place later. The jury just convicts or says there's not enough evidence to convict.
Robert Ferguson, let's take another call. This is Jim in Baltimore. Jim, go right ahead, please.
Hello. Yeah, hi. Great subject, by the way. My issue is that I think there's one question, the privatization of the prison system. I think that plays a role in this problem, too. And the other thing is, the harsher our police forces, the ruthless our criminals become. I think people just see the world as black and white, and they take the humanity out of people. Even the way I think that there's, even the way you're transported or even the way you, are treated, talked. All these things play into how the people that we call criminals, change their lifestyles, And I think basically we don't need 10 or 15% of our population. We just get rid of them in prison systems or in many other ways, And I think the worst issue is that we lost our humanity in this sense. I mean, I just want to find out what the professor thought about the privatization of the system when the law should be in the hands of the government, I think.
The privatization of prisons and other aspects of criminal justice. Yeah.
I actually agree with Jim on this. I think the privatization of prison is an abomination. What we now have are people investing in private prisons, making misery off of the people who are incarcerated. This is wrong. It's a growing phenomenon. Governments try to hide their budgets through this. Most private prisons are poorly run. There's no right of a private company to punish anyone. This is a government function, and farming it out is, as I said, an abomination. And here's another reason why. If you're making money off of people in prison, you want as many people there as possible. The marginal utility curve goes up with the number of people in prison. In some communities, those prisoners are called honey holes because they're making money off of the number of people who are in prison. And the companies that run these private prisons lobby legislatures to keep the prisons high, either through severity of crime, the number of crimes, preventing parole. This is something that government should stop. And I've written about it. I feel passionately about it, and I agree with Jim all the way down the line on it. Government should punish, not private concerns.
Robert Ferguson, our guest in this hour of midday, is a professor in law, literature, and criticism at Columbia University. We're discussing his scholarship and his book, Inferno, An Anatomy of American Punishment. This is Midday. We'll take a short break here and come right back. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with Professor Robert Ferguson from Columbia University Law School. A couple of emails I want to read and get your comments on, Professor. One is from Mike on the two cases we cited, the 51-year-old grandmother sentenced to 40 years, the 15-year-old shooter sentenced to 35. He says, I believe the sentence for the 51-year-old grandmother was excessive. First, she probably has some mental processing issues. As an addict, she is ill and could respond to treatment while incarcerated. Finally, getting out after 20 to 25 years will leave her in a situation where she probably will not be in a position to repeat the horrible actions. As to the 15-year-old shooter, without a comprehensive knowledge of his mental and social state, it is hard to evaluate whether or not 35 years is too long. It could be appropriate, or maybe too short, if he is a sociopath. On the other hand, there are any number of circumstances that would render a 35-year sentence as too harsh and non-productive for society if there were possible opportunities for rehabilitation of a relatively young person. I mean, in both these cases, I raise this question with you and with our listeners. The word correction or corrections in Maryland, and I guess probably in every other state in the country, there's a Department of Corrections and Public Safety, but we don't do a lot of correcting.
Well, that's certainly the case. Let me first apologize to Maggie for misunderstanding part of her question. Coming to Mike, it is hard to know, but I think I can say fairly absolutely that a set sentence of getting this boy out at 50 prevents us from seeing what he might become. Basically, I feel what we miss in terms of punishment. There are lots of reasons for punishing, but what we miss is the fact that every life should continue to be worth living. I don't care whether you're in prison or out of prison. And we're not doing that now. I hesitate to think what this young boy will face when he's in prison for 30 years or what he will be when he comes out, if he ever does come out. On the first case, you're right. This is a question of levels of ignorance and therefore of what kind of responsibility one has for them. The judge came down heavily on the side that ignorance was no excuse. Mike has given us several reasons for thinking differently about the matter. We don't have all of the facts, but on the facts that we know, it does not seem to be the case that this woman would commit another crime of this kind. And it also doesn't seem like there's any way that prison is going to handle what she did.
What do you mean handle what she did? Correct what she did? What do you mean?
Repent. I mean, what we want from somebody in jail is a certain kind of conversion experience. People enter jail or prison and they think, this is what the system is doing to me. And because the system is harsh, many people stay right there. But what you really want is for people to at some point to say, I did this to myself. I am responsible for what I did. Now, this woman said, from your comment, Dan, that the children knew I did not mean to harm them. Well, mm-hmm. Of course, a two-year-old could not know that. But she hasn't completely taken hold of what she did. And I think that might be one of the reasons for the sentence. I don't know. We'd have to look at the judge's sentencing statement. But
let me ask
essentially,
you, I want to go move on to another question from another listener here, Professor Ferguson. David wonders, when I mentioned that the percentage of the world's prison population in the U.S., but what percentage of the world's laws exist in the U.S.? We're a nation of laws. Is it possible that we have more lawbreakers in the U.S. simply because we have more laws?
That is true. We over-criminalize a lot of things. In Massachusetts, at least a couple of years ago, it was a crime or at least a misdemeanor to disturb a pigeon sitting on a nest. So we do have many more laws, mostly because people lobby for them. On the other hand, we also have the technological capacity to put that number of people away. That's a very big factor in this. We're a nation that believes in technology. We can put 1.5 million or more people in prison, even though it's straining the system now. So, yes, the question is right. We have many more ways of breaking the law.
Let's take another call.
I break the law every day by jaywalking in New York City.
Here's another question for you. This one from David in Brooklyn. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Dan. My question is related to the one that you just read in the sense of 40 years for the lady who a jury found guilty of second-degree murder in and of itself sounds really difficult. However, I mean, the judge has to deal with the legal system in its entirety and think yes. about fairness, not just in terms of the system, but the way the law structured fairness across crimes. And right now in Maryland, it's 5 years mandatory if you walk down the street holding a piece of metal in your pocket that at least arguably you have a constitutional right to carry. And that's 5 years mandatory for that. If that's 5 years, it seems reasonable that 40 years is kind of small for actually killing a baby. At least that's what a jury said happened.
All right. I wanted to ask, thank you for bringing that up, David. I wanted to ask Professor Ferguson about the role of elected officials in promulgating laws that put these requirements on judges, the mandatory minimums, for instance. I mean, in the ideal, we are a nation of laws and not of men, but men and women in legislatures, in the General Assembly of Maryland and other assemblies, influence punishment by passing laws that require, you know, sentencing for certain offenses. So in that sense, this is representative. Therefore, the laws represent the wish of the people in terms of the severity of the punishment.
Well, I actually think our legislatures are the most irresponsible punishers in our midst. It's very easy. Every legislature, even if it does very little else, passes at least a couple of laws about breaking the law. And many of them are redundant. Many of them are pressured by various pressure groups for whatever reason. I think our political figures are basically cowardly on this subject. No one wants to be caught being lenient on crime. It should stop. The phrase law and order was first used in this country to defend slavery. That's the mantra that is used now to justify harsh laws and increasing them. You should not vote for people who speak this way.
Another place I have a problem is with parole. And here in Maryland, it's particularly acute. I find this particularly offensive to me. To sentence someone to life in prison and say they have the possibility of parole, and then have a politician, in this case the elected governor of Maryland, have the power to say, never mind. Have a parole commission in place to consider parole for individuals who are eligible for it after a certain amount of time, to actually find that they are ready to go out of prison at the age of whatever, 50, 55, 60 years old after being in prison a long time, serving a life sentence. And then to have the governor, the elected official, say, the politician say, no, you can't do that. I'm not going to approve of this parole that's been approved by the parole commission. So that's what we face in Maryland and in two other states where governors have that kind of power. And to me, that's the political influence in criminal justice I find it very troubling, especially in that case.
Well, the pardoning power is not used very frequently in this country.
No.
There are reasons for that. Governors are ambitious. Usually they want to be more than governors. You get to be president of this country by being either tough on crime or being silent about it, not by addressing the problems that are related to it. In the last two presidential debates, I think no one mentioned the problem of incarceration. It just wasn't on the table. Here's one other way to answer that last question. On proportionality grounds. When we try to execute somebody, or when we do, people meet and hold candlelight services, they pray, they protest. When we put somebody away for life without parole, nobody blinks an eye. And yet we're committing somebody to a special form of hell that way, because there's no hope then. There's no way in which one can possibly improve oneself in that situation. And improvement is what we all live for.
A special form of hell, the reference to Inferno, the title of your book, from the coda in your book about Dante's epic poem.
I use some literary examples in my writing because the law does not talk. It talks a lot about sentencing, talks a lot about what prosecutors should do. It rarely talks about what punishment actually is, except in small clinics. Literature talks about it all the time. So you can use examples from literature to cover what the law is silent about. One of your earlier questioners, I think it was Maggie, said our governments have no heart. Most institutions have no heart. But the fact is that literature can sort of show you what we're doing in a way that the law finesses. So that's why I use literary examples. And I use Dante, not so much for Inferno, but because of Purgatorio, which is about hope and
right.
punishment.
Well, that's where you think the future could be. If indeed there's a tide shift here, a tide change, and people are starting to see, and governments are starting to look at the prison systems and say, we've gone overboard here. If indeed that's happening, your solution is Purgatorio.
Well, it's more than that. I think our problem goes beyond mass incarceration. I think even if we solve that problem, we will still punish people in ways that is not helpful to anyone in our prison system. So I really want to change the whole way in which punishment is thought about, and that's what I intend to write about next.
Well, but you get us to at least purgatory, right? From Inferno to Purgatorio, where there's at least the chance of Paradiso.
Well, there's development, movement, improvement.
Right.
You're thinking about people's capabilities and not just about their crimes.
Let's take one more call here. Maureen in Catonsville. You just have to be brief, Maureen. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you, Dan. I was very blessed to hear Piper Kerman, the author of Orange is the New Black, Loyola last night. And I guess the briefest thing to say is get on her website and look at the data that she has compiled on who is in prison and why they're in prison and the disparities in the length of sentences. She's very articulate and, of course, has used her experience to begin to make a difference and make some noise. The other thing that I was particularly impressed by was I think you could make the case that Piper had moved on from that life. She was the first offender. There was no reason to put her in jail. But she's very articulate about how her experience in the women's prison at Danbury really gave her the opportunity to see the consequences of her action.
Okay. Thank you, Maureen. We'll have to leave it on that note and thank Robert Ferguson for his time today and his book. I've really enjoyed this and got a lot out of it, especially the literary references. And you turned me on to a Victor Hugo, a short novel that I somehow have missed over the years and my interest in the death penalty in particular. So I'll make sure I get to that. Thank you, Professor Ferguson.
Thank you. I very much enjoyed it.
Yeah, same here. Thank you. Robert Ferguson is the George Edward Woodberry Professor in Law, Literature, and Criticism at Columbia University. We're speaking to him from New York. His book is Inferno, An Anatomy of American Punishment, which is published by the Harvard University Press. Hope you enjoyed the first hour of our show. Please stay tuned for the second hour of Midday coming up. We're going to take a break for lunch and the news. Lunch today provided by Apples and Oranges Fresh Market, offering breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Its catering menu includes deli and sandwich platters, fruit and cheese plates, and desserts. You can find Apples and Oranges Fresh Market open daily at 1900 North Broadway in Baltimore. More information at applesandorangesmarket.com. See you for the second hour of Midday.